Parkinson's disease. It's an epidemic.
If you look at 1990 to 2015, it slightly more than doubles in the number, right? And then if you look at 2015 up to 2040, the next 25-year epic, it's going to more than double again. So we're talking now, we're getting into, you know, big, big numbers, you know, 12 million, 13 million, 14 million, you know, and some people say we're undercounting for various reasons. And so, you know, when you think about that, you know, it has all these implications for society.
That's Dr. Michael Okun. We talk with him about the book he co-authored, Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. He tells us about symptoms, causes, and new treatments. But first, we talk with novelist Lionel Shriver about her latest foray into burning questions for our times. This one asks, as per its title, should we stay or should we go? Should we cut our lives short before reaching possible decrepitude? Or should we stick around for come what may? That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. Once you reach a certain age, you start thinking about the end, especially if your parents' golden years turned out to be depressingly tarnished. Some people want to take their fate into their own hands, but is that even possible? In her new novel, Should We Stay or Should We Go?, Lionel Shriver takes a deep dive into whether we can take control of our deaths, and should we. The couple at the center of her story make a pact to take their lives when their younger partner by 1 year reaches 80. Shriver writes 12 alternate outcomes to that decision, almost every possible scenario, to explore the vicissitudes of fate, chance, and contemporary society's attitude toward death. Lionel Shriver's fiction includes The Mandibles, Property, the National Book Award finalist So Much for That, and the international bestseller We Need to Talk About Kevin. Shriver is also a journalist who's written for many publications. She's been on Writer's Voice before, most recently in 2013, talking about her novel, Big Brother. Lionel Shriver, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure.
So this book, Should We Stay or Should We Go?, like others of your novels, is an exploration of an idea. But unlike others, it explores multiple versions of the story, each to different possibilities or outcomes. It features a couple, Cyril and Kay, in the UK, who decide that when they're in a still healthy middle age, they decide to do themselves in when they reach 80. Tell us about Cyril and Kay, and why do they make this pact?
Well, Kay is a nurse, and Cyril is a GP, and they both work for the National Health Service in Britain, which is a little-known fact, the fifth largest employer in the world. I made them doctors because that meant they would have had a lot of interaction with elderly patients, so that advancing decay is not an abstraction for them. And furthermore, when the book begins, Kay's father has just died after over 10 years of devastating and ruinous dementia, to the point where, you know, she lost her real father so long ago that once he finally dies, she can't bring herself to cry. And it's really that occasion that moves her husband to propose that, you know, we've seen what is coming up. I don't want us to end that way ourselves, and it's time to be proactive. Why don't we make a pact that once you, Kay, have turned 80 and I'll be 81, we will call it quits. The book then immediately zooms forward to right before they're about to get to Kay's birthday in 2020. And the thing about making this kind of a pact is that it's all very easy to agree that you don't want to be here anymore beyond the age of 80 when you're still in your early 50s. It's quite another matter when you're already 79.
Yeah, exactly. And what motivated you to take up this big question? Should we stay or should we go?
Well, I mean, personally, two things, really. First off, I have very elderly parents. My mother's about to turn 90. My father is already 93. And they're not in the best of shape. So, you know, that again, for me, this is not an abstract matter. And my parents are so old that I myself am now getting old. And therefore, you know, looking at the next tranche of my life, I mean, I'm right at that point where it suddenly starts to seem as if old age could actually happen. And I know that's ridiculous because we all realize superficially that unless some kind of misadventure intervenes, of course we're going to get old. But I don't think we believe it, not in our heart of hearts.
And, you know, the whole point of this exercise of doing away with themselves is to avoid the decrepitude of age, as you point out. I took care of my mother the last 4 years of her life when she declined from being a vital, active artist to, as she said, someone who'd lost half her brain. And she was also suffering from a multitude of serious and really debilitating conditions. Yet she got tremendous enjoyment out of life, and she really wasn't keen to leave it. She engaged robustly with people. Kay, in this novel, one of the iterations of the story is that she falls into dementia, but it isn't all that bad for her. Maybe it's even good for her. So I wonder, you know, what's your point in that version?
Yes, that's a chapter in which what happens to Kay is what most of us are most worried about, which is losing our minds. But I told that chapter from her perspective, and she goes through a period of finding her poor memory and the kind of stupid domestic mistakes she makes around the house. You know, she puts capers in her spotted dick instead of currants. It's not the same. So she's frustrated with herself for a while, but that subsides, and along with it, any consciousness that there's anything wrong with her. And I believe this is a fairly commonplace arc. Now, which direction you go when you are demented is very idiosyncratic. And in this instance, I had Kay become simply amazed by everything, thrilled by everything, easily amused. She does remember scraps of things, and she kind of puts them together in her head like a collage. And actually, Kay is perfectly happy. The universe seems marvelous and strange. It's the people around her, when you listen to some of the scraps of dialogue that interweave the chapter, it's the people around her who are unhappy.
And maybe there's a lesson in that for them as well. I did think after my mother died, you know, I've kind of been kicking myself ever since because I tried to bring her back to reality and really at the times when she departed from reality. And maybe I really shouldn't have done that. I caused more harm to her and more anguish to myself by trying that.
Yeah, I think that's a regular problem for carers because the demented will also often, you know, forget their spouse is dead, right? So do you have to keep telling them, I'm sorry, your husband died 3 years ago? And what will often happen is that they'll have to relive the grief because this is news to them. They didn't remember that. And I think at a certain point, a lot of carers give up on trying to pull the patient back to reality and just let them live in whatever world they want to.
And now back to this novel, Should We Stay or Should We Go? Kay, in many of these versions, is really not completely on board with the idea, but she does go along with it, at least apparently. Why?
She thinks that Cyril has a point, and he does have a point. Her resistance to the idea is emotional, that it seems to her unrealistic to expect that once they get to an arbitrary arithmetic age, that they will sacrifice what could be several more years of being in okay health. Who knows? And that's one of the problems with being so drastic, is that you have no idea how long you might have lived beyond that in a state of relative contentment. And in fact, that's one of the purposes of the parallel universe structure of the novel, because I'm looking at, in any number of instances, well, okay, let's say they don't go through with their vow. What would they miss out on? Or what would they escape?
Now, one of the things that they don't necessarily escape is the archetypal white van, which makes an appearance in several of the versions. What is that archetype, and where did you get the image of the white van?
There's a set expression in Britain called the white van man. They have a terrible reputation. They're known to, you know, run over pedestrians in crosswalks. They drive very fast. They're always in a state of fury. And for some reason, their vans are always white. That's just one of the, it's a little emblem of Britishness that I weave in different ways through the book. In fact, that's one of the fun things about the parallel universe structure, is that you can hit little notes and hit those same notes in different situations and different chapters in a way that it can be quite satisfying. So, you know, there's one situation in which the white van man takes out one of the characters. There's another situation in which the white van man almost takes out one of the characters and makes her sobered and come to a different decision. I tried to use little bits and pieces in different ways throughout the book that give it a sense of unity, and you can expect certain themes to come back, but not necessarily in the same way. It's very, the whole book is very playful, and that's just one of those elements.
So, you know, even Cyril, who seems to be the real motivator behind this idea of suicide, or let's say euthanasia, even he comes up against the body's overweening urge to live. So talk a little bit about that. You know, no matter how much we may want to do something, the life force is pretty darn strong.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that this whole conversation about physician-assisted suicide in some ways is overblown, because the fact is, a very few people are likely to avail themselves of it, because it's really hard to kill yourself. And, you know, even physically, it's hard to kill yourself. But emotionally, it doesn't compute. You know, it's like, what do you mean? And there is a passage in the book that it talks about the body wants to keep living. And it does. You are programmed to keep living under any circumstance. And in that passage, it says, you know, we get bored, but the body doesn't get bored. The body can continue to live and will continue to live, even if you're completely sick of life. And that is a force that I got more appreciation for as I wrote the book. In fact, there's one chapter in which Kay goes ahead and does as her husband has urged her, and he waits until the medication has has done its work. And then suddenly some aspect of himself that is very deep inside, not his sort of superficial consciousness, but something much more animal, will not let him take those drugs himself. It was just out of the question. And it hits up against his essential self-regard. He's an ideologue. He can be kind of a pain, actually, because he obviously thinks rather well of himself. But he thinks well enough of himself that he simply will not throw himself in the bin.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Lionel Shriver about her latest book, Should We Stay or Should We Go? You know, in one of the iterations, the couple are discovered, well, maybe in more than one, but in this one in particular, the couple are discovered before they can complete the deed, and they're shut away in a hellish facility for the mentally ill. This is, they're shut away because, you know, they must be mentally ill because they tried to harm themselves. It's a pretty extreme place. Talk about this chapter and why it goes the way it goes.
Well, it's one of their children who intervenes and stops them from going through with it. And so all three kids get together and decide, well, you know, our parents are a threat to themselves and we don't have any choice. And so they get the British state to take control of their whereabouts. I mean, they're sectioned. And so they don't have any choice. They don't go to this care home voluntarily, and they don't have a choice of what institution they choose. And it turns out that they're extremely unlucky. And this is a real hellhole. And it's, you know, it's meant to be completely over the top, right? It's the worst care home experience I could design. And, you know, they have these horrible but mandatory group activities with pathetic little sitting in place exercises and sing-alongs of the kind of songs that I hate. and this was just an exploration of how bad can it get. Yes, it can get really, really bad. In fact, it was meant purposefully to allude to Ken Kesey's Cuckoo's Nest. Worst threat.
And I thought to myself, is this satire or actually is this reality? Because as much as people on the outside can think, oh, this is over the top, this is satire, I can tell you from having worked in the mental health field that there's some pretty horrible places out there, and they may be actually pretty close to this portrayal.
Yeah, I think it does get bad. One of the pairings of chapters I put together was there's the bad care home, and then there's the good care home. That's the nicest place I could design. You know, they have snooker tables. They have a pool. It's on the coast. You can go for walks on the beach. You know, they have restaurant level cuisine. You know, wild mushroom fajitas and heirloom tomatoes. And it's very, very expensive, but it couldn't be nicer. The trouble is that it's still a care home. You don't have control over your life, and you have been ultimately socially sidelined. And that's the chapter in which it's called the precautionary principle. And that's in which the couple decides that the answer is not to kill themselves when they get to 80, but to prepare for decay and to plan for being old in a way that so many people fail to. So they find this terrific care home called Journey's End. They save up all their money to make sure that they'll be able to afford it. And then they enter assisted living in their early 70s, which is on, you know, that that's pushing the program a bit. And, you know, Kay ends up wondering whether, you know, she buried them alive too soon, that maybe what they should have done is what everyone else does, and live life to the fullest until you can't, and then you go into a care home.
Yeah, and also, you know, the outside world has a way of upending all the plans that people make. Did you write this after the COVID-19 pandemic started, or did it happen while you were working on the book?
I started it before the pandemic, in December of 2019. One of the weird things about the process of writing the book is that, you know, there's this pivotal date in the book, which is Kay's 80th birthday, from which all the other chapters spring. And I wanted it to be super contemporary. So knowing that it would take me a little while to write the book and then to get it published, I thought I'll push it a little bit. And I'll make this pivotal date 3 months later, right? So in December, I chose the date of the 29th of March, 2020. Reasoning, 3 months, what could happen? Oh, my Lord. And so what I ended up doing is having to do some rewriting with the earlier work to include the pandemic. And I ended up being grateful for the pandemic. It's just more material. It's another story to weave through the book and to have different consequences depending on which chapter you're in. There's one chapter in which the economy bounces back fantastically from all these lockdowns and, you know, the future is rosy. And then there's another chapter in which no matter how much money the governments make up to pump into the system, it doesn't work. And the response to COVID-19 eventually leads to fiscal collapse. So, and with the nice thing with the parallel universe structure is that both of these things can be true in the same book. I can't be wrong.
Right, exactly. And that is really that's the charm of this book, that one really gets to explore the idea and all the options. And in fact, I'd like to ask you, what's your thinking on this, having written this now? What's your position? Is it more courageous to take the slings and arrows that fortune sends our way, or to do away with oneself before they bring us down?
I don't have a precise position. I mean, the thing about this dozen scenarios is that none of them seems to have the answer. There's only one chapter, it's the next to last one, which would be in any way entirely desirable. It's called Once Upon a Time in Lambeth. And it's a fairy tale. It's a caricature of what we would want for our old age. So they don't get uglier, they get more beautiful. everyone loves them. They become ever more successful in their careers. They experience no pain. They do lots of exercise and eat lots of vegetables. So, I mean, it's one thing on top of the other. It's completely ludicrous. And the point of that chapter is, this is the one thing you can count on that it's not going to happen, right? This fantasy you've got of your ideal old age in which everything goes right and nothing ever really breaks down and you just become a lovelier and wiser person. That's the one thing that ain't going to happen.
Well, it could happen, but it's rare.
Unlikely.
Unlikely, exactly. And, you know, you also explore the idea. Now, this was really interesting. An immortality drug or virtual immortality drug, certainly an extremely longevity drug, gets discovered at this time. What is your thought on all these life extension projects that we have and the very idea of life extension itself?
I think there is a pretty hard limit on how long a human body can survive. It's only built for a certain period of time. And we have obviously elongated that fantastically. But unfortunately, the part of our lives that we have elongated, I mean, you can't elongate the youth part. We've elongated the worst part. And I'm very ambivalent about that. I mean, I suppose I am fortunate to be a member of a generation given more time on this earth, but I am leery of those last few years. And I think there is a great deal of merit in writing out an advanced directive that tells your future doctors all the treatments you don't want once you cross a certain age or once your health is in sufficient decline. You know, you can actually write out, I do not want this set, I don't want CPR. I don't want to have a bone marrow transplant. Don't give me flu vaccines. You know, if I'm badly demented, don't use all these life-saving techniques and drugs on me to keep me going. And the medical establishment is organized to continue to pile medical treatment upon medical treatment on very, very old people. There is no system of, you know, pressing a button and saying stop. And often the elderly people themselves are in no shape to even ask for it to stop. The medical treatment has a kind of momentum and a life of its own. And somehow we've got to reorganize this. I mean, we are squandering a huge percentage of our resources on keeping people alive, especially during the last 6 months of their life. It's frequently the case that you will spend as much money on the last miserable 6 months of your life as you will on the rest of your life.
Yes, and it's a grim prospect indeed, and one that you explore in all its potential iterations in this novel, Should We Stay or Should We Go? Lionel Shriver, thank you so much for talking with us here.
I much enjoyed it.
Lionel Shriver. Read an excerpt or listen to an audio sample of Should We Stay or Should We Go? At writersvoice.net. Next up, the Parkinson's epidemic and what to do about it. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Brain diseases are now the world's leading source of disability. The fastest growing of these is Parkinson's. The number of impacted patients has doubled to more than 6 million over the last 25 years and is projected to double again by 2040. Harmful pesticides that increase the risk of Parkinson's continue to proliferate. Many people remain undiagnosed and untreated, and the most effective treatment is now a half century old. My guest, Dr. Robert Okun, is among the world's foremost experts in Parkinson's disease, both as a researcher and a clinician. He's teamed up with three other leading experts in the field for a new book that's part of a campaign to end Parkinson's. It's called End Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. Together with Drs. Ray Dorsey, Todd Shearer, and Bastian Bloom, Dr. Okun shares their plan to help prevent Parkinson's, improve care and treatment, and end the silence associated with Parkinson's disease. Well, Dr. Michael Okun, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So this book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, a prescription for Action, you are one of four authors of this. Just tell me a little bit briefly about how this project came together.
Yeah, so, you know, we as a group, so there's four Parkinson experts, and we've been doing this our whole career, so a couple of decades each for us. And it's Ray Dorsey at the University of Rochester, and Ray's a super expert in, you know, public health economics, pesticides, and Todd Scherer, who's the CEO of the Michael J. Fox Foundation. He did a lot of his work when he was at Emory with Tim Greenemeyer looking at pesticides and Parkinson. Boston Bloom runs the largest and founded the largest sort of program for multidisciplinary care all over the Netherlands. And now has been piloting these models all over the world and is another world expert in Parkinson. And I'm kind of the straggler behind. I'm a professor and the executive director of the Norman Fixell Institute at the University of Florida. And I've spent a few decades working on Parkinson-related therapies and studying how brain signals and building devices. And so I took kind of the research, and together we, you know, sort of had a lot of discussions and a lot of vision about what is the prescription of action? You know, what's going to be the path forward for a disease like Parkinson that's growing so quickly?
Yes. And in fact, you're hardly a straggler. You were the first to characterize the Parkinson pandemic. Before we get any further, just give us a Cliff Notes version of what is Parkinson's and what are the symptoms of it?
Yeah, so Parkinson's disease is actually not one disease. And so that's the first confusing thing for the public. But it's a group of symptoms that we sort of cluster together and we refer to it as Parkinson. And so some people have tremor, some have stiffness, some have slowness. And you know, we put together this package of what we call the motor symptoms. These are like the visible things we can see. And most people identify Parkinson with the tremor, for example. But we know that only 4 out of 5 folks with Parkinson have tremor. 1 out of 5 don't. So you could miss that diagnosis. But Parkinson is extremely complicated. It also affects other symptoms like depression and anxiety. And a lot of the disability are from these things that you can't see. And it's been called the most complex disease in clinical medicine because it's, you know, so vast with all the different symptoms, all the different therapies. And we know that it's from degeneration of cells within multiple circuits in the brain. And people talk a lot about dopamine, you know, dopamine and reward and dopamine and brain diseases and dopamine and Parkinson. But Parkinson does affect those cells. Those cells die, the dopamine cells, but there are other circuits in the brain that get affected and cause all these other symptoms. So you can see, even as I'm explaining it, how we try to boil it down for the public, and it can be confusing, you know, in thinking about the construct, because everybody can look different, because when you have that many symptoms, the mix is different for each individual who has this disease.
And in fact, you write in this book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, that it often goes undiagnosed.
That's right. You know, worldwide, you know, it's the fastest growing now neurological disease, which is, you know, kind of a mind-blowing statement in itself. And we recently met with the World Health Organization. But, you know, most people worldwide don't have access to a brain doctor, which we would call a neurologist. And we know the outcomes are better when you have access to a neurologist with this this particular disease, but it goes undiagnosed and missed in a lot of places around the world. And a lot of people think, oh, there's no tremor, it must not be Parkinson. A lot of people don't recognize all these other symptom complexes, or they think you're too young. And I always say, well, come have clinic with me every day at the University of Florida, and you'll see people who are teens and little kids with Parkinson all the way up to centenarians. And so it, of course, becomes more prevalent as you age, and we see it in all ages. And so people can get fooled. And you know, I think that's on us, to be honest with you. I think we need to do a better job of educating and getting the word out.
And this book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, which I have to say is eminently readable, is a huge step forward in that direction. Now, this Parkinson's pandemic, I mean, it's not just increasing because people are getting older. You say there's really an almost exponential rate of growth in this disease. Give us the outline of that pandemic, of that rise.
Yeah. So Ray Dorsey, who's, you know, a good friend and a co-author, is really the expert at this. And when Ray and his team dug into this, and then we had a lot of discussions among the co-authors, the numbers are really staggering. And if you calculate in 25-year epochs, so periods of 25 years, if you look at 1990 to 2015, it's slightly more than doubles in the number, right? And then if you look at 2015 up to 2040, the next 25-year epoch, it's going to more than double again. And so we're talking, now we're getting into, you know, big, big numbers, you know, 12 million, 13 million, 14 million, you know, and some people say we're undercounting for various reasons. And so, you know, when you think about that, you know, it has all these implications for society, you know, and the implications are you have more people are going to be suffering, more people are going to need therapies, but it's also going to stress healthcare systems. There's going to be more people that need access, more drugs, more therapies, more costs, more hip fractures. And I don't think people realize when you start to add it up, and Ray is kind of the economist of the group, these numbers could collapse, you know, healthcare systems, including our own, if we let them go unchecked. And so it's not just the suffering. There's also a potential economic societal impact of this growth. And people say, well, why is it growing that way? And we say, well, people used to say it was all because you get older. And it's true. You know, as you get older, you get more degenerative diseases like Parkinson. But as we dug into the problem, it's not just age. It's other factors that are driving this growth. Some we can see and some we can't see. And that's part of what we talk about in the book.
Yeah, and that's what's so important about this book. You know, I spent many years, in fact, in public health and occupational health and safety. I was an advocate, an educator, a trainer, worked on improving laws, trained workers on, you know, occupational hazards, including things like, you know, exposures to toxic chemicals. So I found this book very interesting because so often diseases like cancer and now, for example, Parkinson's disease, the link to chemical exposures is not made. And you put that right up front and center. It's not the only one. But talk about pesticides, trichloroethylene or TCE, and other, and paraquat, other toxins that are so abundant in our environment and their link to this Parkinson's pandemic.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of what we see is tip of the iceberg. And, you know, when you scratch the surface, you realize we've got some serious issues. And about 20 years ago, when I was kind of getting into this area in my own lab, you know, if you had come to me and said, you know, Parkinson is strongly environmental, I probably wouldn't have, you know, I don't think I would have argued with you because I'm not that kind of guy, but I would have thought about it, but it wouldn't have really crossed my mind as being something super important. And the reason for that is in science, we like to publish findings and we like to see replication of those findings before we believe something. And when we say a chemical is associated with Parkinson or a pesticide is associated with Parkinson, we want the proof, right? And the proof isn't just in one study. We want to see multiple studies across multiple continents, right? So fast forward in my own career now, as the years went by, we started to accumulate those studies. And those studies have different statistics, you know, that are like if you're making a bet in Las Vegas and, you know, these odds ratios or these bets that you make that you're going to get Parkinson later with exposures, we started to see consistent numbers for a number of those chemicals. One is paraquat, that's a pesticide sprayed on in agriculture to kill pests and things. Remember, CIDE, C-I-D-E, is the Latin term for killer, right? So a pesticide, herbicide, fungicide, it's whatever is in front. You kill the fungus, you kill the pest. And so we didn't realize this. And so we're spraying that stuff, but we also didn't realize things like trichloroethylate that's common in dry cleaning and degreasers and certain industries is has a very high conversion of people that were exposed to getting Parkinson later in life. And so now that we have this information, one of the things that we argue in the book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, is shall we not act now that we're beginning to see this show up multiple times? And it was the same for Agent Orange, and nobody believed it at first. And the studies keep showing replication, study after study showing that replication.
I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer in a way, because these chemicals are neurotoxins by and large. And, you know, life, I mean, we may not look like insects, but we share a lot of DNA with them.
Yeah, it is totally true. You know, we're all interconnected, you know, on the planet. And you know, it's not so much that any of us are against, you know, certain pesticides or certain chemicals. We're not. I mean, none of the co-authors have any, you know, sort of inherent bias. Like, we didn't come into this because we were, you know, like, we really wanted to go after these things. We just, you know, think that it's important that once we do uncover these links, that we bring it to the attention of people. And of course, the United States government, when there are spills, they have what are called Superfund sites. And you can Google and find out where the Superfund sites are all over the U.S. And it's publicly available knowledge where there have been spills of things like TCE or trichloroethylate and dioxin, which is a component that, you know, you see in Agent Orange, and you can see where all these things are. And in fact, I often say, Ray says this too, like, how many miles is your house from the nearest Superfund site? I think his is a mile or two closer to one than mine. Not a competition you want to win, but mine is 11 miles and sits right next to my favorite pizza shop here at the University of Florida. So, you know, I think it's important. You know, I just think that, you know, it's not so much that we can fix everything, but we got to open our eyes as we go forward here. And we've got to warn people if we really think that the science is showing us something important. And so that's why it's one of the three things that we've advocated in our red card campaign to the White House, that, you know, like, we need to ban certain pesticides or replace them with something else that might be a safer approach, you know, and then there are replacements that can be put forward, you know, in order to save the next generation and try to make that curve maybe not quite as steep, you know, of the growth of Parkinson.
Say that initiative of Carts to the White House. What was that?
Yeah. So as part of the Ending Parkinson's Disease book, it spawned this very beautiful thing where we talk about the pact. So the idea of, we studied what it would take to end a disease if that was possible. And so that was kind of the construct of the book. I don't think any of the authors believe that we can end all of Parkinson's disease, you know, right away or anytime soon, but we've got to have that prescription, right? And so we looked at other diseases like polio and HIV, and we said, you know, what did they do, right? So it's a good starting point. And we realized there was a formula, and the formula is what we call a PACT. And each letter of the word PACT stands for something. So P stands for prevent, A stands for advocate, C for care, and T for developing treatments. And when we think about the PACT, we realize in order to tip, we've got to have to be much more aggressive in our Parkinson advocacy. I mean, I've been the medical director and medical advisor for the Parkinson Foundation since 2006. Spent my career advocating as well as researching, and I'm just giving myself a bad grade. I mean, I've tried really hard, but we need more people on board. And so when the book was published, a group came forward called the Parkinson Disease Avengers, the PD Avengers on Twitter and on Facebook, and they're starting to go viral. They've got a few thousand members, and they're just growing like crazy. And with them, we launched a campaign called the Red Card Campaign, Give a Dime for Parkinson. And you mail a postcard to the White House, and on the postcard, you know, you'd say why you give a dime. Maybe it's your father has Parkinson disease, and you want to do something for him or your mother or your grandma, or maybe you do. And we send that message forward, and we ask the White House for three things. One, you know, we need to ban the chemicals we know are associated for the next generation with the potential onset of Parkinson. Two, we need to make telehealth permanent. People don't realize that COVID-19 brought us telehealth, but I can tell you for over 10 years, I fought for it alongside the Parkinson's Foundation and the Michael J. Fox Foundation and others to make that a reality. And we made very little headway. And then 10 years of the work that we did was, we got more done in the first 10 days of the pandemic, but this is not permanent. So we have to, you know, push them to make it permanent so we can bring healthcare into the home. And then we're asking for a 10 times increase budget on research for the National Institutes of Health, the largest funder of health in the world. And we base those numbers based on the research where we've seen the tipping point for other diseases. And so those are the three things on the red card, and it's at endingpd.org. And in fact, the book and the campaign and everything goes to charity. So none of the four of us are taking anything from this book except trying to raise awareness. And we love this. We love a grassroots movement, and this is what it's going to take.
And the book is Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. And we are talking with Dr. Michael Okun, one of the four authors of this book. And when you say telehealth, and we should explain then to our listeners that it's because so many Parkinson's patients are homebound. Medicare, for example, does not pay for telehealth, although I believe it did start paying for telehealth care related to COVID, if I'm not mistaken, during the pandemic. And so it's what's so valuable, I think, about this book is that you really do place this disease within the nexus of a systemic approach, because you're talking about banning pesticides. You're talking about increasing access. You're talking about controlling the cost of drugs. You talk about diet and exercise. And in fact, I'd like to go on now to some of those, you know, those things that help prevent or minimize, you know, or alleviate the symptoms of Parkinson's. Talk about the role. Well, one thing we haven't talked about, by the way, is the role of head trauma. So maybe talk briefly about that, and then tell us why exercise and a certain kind of exercise is really important to prevent and treat Parkinson's.
Yeah. So on the topic of head trauma, again, it's one of these stories where, you know, I tell all the students and fellows that I get to train at University of Florida, and I tell all of the persons with disease that I have the honor of caring for, I tell everybody, every day I practice medicine, I know less. I've just kind of lived by this adage, and you have to be very humble because things change, you know, from year to year. And unless you look back and you're honest with yourself, you won't see that happen. And the pesticide story is one of those stories in Parkinson. Another of them is head trauma. The head trauma story is, you know, super important because I don't think people put two and two together. But again, as study after study came forward and the data showed, it shows a clear association with head trauma and the later occurrence of Parkinson as a risk factor, in particular, repeated head traumas. And we now, within our clinic at the Norman Fixell Institute, we now commonplace as part of the degenerative spectrum now care for people with traumatic brain injuries and head traumas because we're seeing the delayed effects that can set off degenerative diseases. And so we're trying to help as many of these folks as we can, follow them forward and figure out the link. But there's clearly, like pesticide, there's clearly a link. In terms of exercise is super interesting. I'm going to tell you something that you may find really, really fascinating. And that's that before we had dopamine, which, remember, dopamine replacement is still the single best treatment over 50 years old for the treatment of Parkinson, which is another reason why we need research. But before we had dopamine, a lot of folks with Parkinson just stayed in the hospital or were in what would be maybe called institutions or like permanent residence in some sort of medical facility. And, you know, when doctors went on rounds, and this was how I started too, you'd go on rounds. The hospitals are shaped in U-shapes, and you put your charts on a rack and you would round. You'd go in a round, you go in a circle until you get the whole ward, right? And we would actually hear stories of before dopamine on these, you know, rounds, they would have the persons with Parkinson push the chart cart, and they would fold towels, and the more active that they would make them, the better they would get. This was pre-levodopa, pre-treatment. And fast forward now, you know, it's true. And for a lot of my career, we used to say exercise is like a drug for Parkinson. And now we're just seeing study after study show symptomatic benefits, you know, from exercising and different forms of exercise and all sorts of journals, from New England Journal down. And this is really fascinating. And Melissa Armstrong and I wrote a review for JAMA last year. This year, Bosch Bloom and I and Christine Klein were at one for Lancet. And exercise is now a first-line recommended therapy by Parkinson experts. It really does improve the symptoms of Parkinson.
And it's a kind of exercise that is especially helpful. I found that interesting. It's you know, it's not just your stroll around, although I'm sure that helps too. But you talked about forced exercise. Explain that.
Actually, the kind of founder of forced exercise was a guy named Jay Alberts, just absolutely brilliant guy. And he and I were at Emory together, and I used to drive my persons with Parkinson and other diseases over to a laboratory that was next door to his. And that's where we met. He started studying my people when I was up there, and we became good friends. He went on to the Cleveland Clinic. And what was interesting was the grant I was working on was, you know, people say, you know, how many failures do you have to get success? It was a complete failure. But he was just kind of latching on and testing the folks, and he developed some great grip strength protocols. And then one of our people that we brought over, he put on a bike, and it was a tandem bike, and he put it on the back of the bike, and he would ride across Iowa. He was from Iowa, and he started this great charity as part of that. But he noticed when she would get off the bike that she would do better. And so he came up with this idea, you know, of forcing a certain number of RPM and forced exercise. And he's developed protocols for forced exercise, which seems to be one of the things that can help at least some people with Parkinson. Now, I tell people, remember, not everybody is an Olympic athlete, right? So you can't do this. So at first, when people read it, they overinterpret it, and everybody goes to, you know, to the local gym and gets a trainer and starts forcing the exercise, and then they actually do worse because, you know, there is a different limit of precision for each person. But it's absolutely fascinating. Another researcher I worked with at Emory, Christopher Haas, he did work with Tai Chi when he was at Emory. And now Tai Chi has been published by the Oregon Group and the New England Journal. So there's a whole bunch of, you know, positive studies, randomized studies of different techniques. So it's fascinating. But to me, it goes all the way back to the people pushing the chart rack with Parkinson and folding the towels. You know, there was something to it.
Right. And we should say with force, you're not forcing people to do exercise. You're just pushing them to do a little bit more intense work than they might normally feel comfortable in doing.
Yeah. So you force the revolutions per minute of how fast you're having them pedal. You kind of force them to stay at a certain speed. And it's not for everyone, but yeah, but that's the underpin of the exercise. For somebody like me that likes to walk the dog and get my exercise in different ways, I don't like to be forced to do anything. So I think there's something for everyone, but it's pretty interesting.
You'd be the Tai Chi type person. So yeah. You also are a pioneer, I believe, in deep brain stimulation. So talk about deep brain stimulation, and then I'm going to ask you about gene therapy, because, you know, it's not just about prevention, but as you say, the last one on there is treatment. Of course, it's a lot cheaper to prevent than to treat, but there are some hopeful signs on the horizon.
You know, we all talk about our lives and the great people that you meet and teach you. And, you know, one of the great mentors in my life was working early on in my training with a guy named Malin DeLong, who was at Johns Hopkins. And, you know, he figured out all the circuits in one of the most complex areas of the brain called the basal ganglia. This area, nobody wanted to touch it because it was so complicated. And Malin went in and did a series of simple, elegant experiments over many years at Hopkins and then at Emory, and really uncoded it. And he won the Lasker Award in 2015 or 2014 and for his work and understanding how these circuits connect really allowed us, you know, to expand back into a surgical approach. So could we change the way the different islands that Malin was listening to with his ears, could we change the way in which they were talking to each other and develop therapies to do that? And then he brought a number of us along in his lab. And for the past couple of decades, I've been one of his pupils. And so we've been listening to the way that different brain cells talk to each other and trying to develop, you know, new approaches and new treatments. You know, fundamentally, we're learning that the different movements, the different emotions, the different things that make you human have a, they have a signals that underpin them. And so we've been able to stimulate the brain to alleviate human suffering and various symptoms of Parkinson, but not all the symptoms. And we're trying to develop new technologies. So our laboratories work a lot on, you know, how can we understand this and develop the next generation so these therapies can be more precise with more benefits in areas that matter to people with less side effects. And the devices are smart. So there's, we're starting to train them to be able to respond to certain symptoms. And so this is kind of neuromodulation. We're in one area of that. There are other people doing other forms of neuromodulation, like putting light and genetics into the brain called optogenetics in the lab. Cancer researchers have designer receptor drugs that they go at precision. But I think the point that I'm trying to make is there are these circuits in the brain for people listening that underpin Parkinson. And it's in very simple terms, there's just this abnormal conversation. You know, the brain looks pretty normal if you get an MRI, but the regions are talking to each other in very abnormal ways. And it was really great for me to be around someone like Malin DeLong who understood that and understood that complexity and tried to simplify it and put together, you know, the framework so others could come in and start stimulating different areas of the brain and really moving it into the modern era.
Well, this has just been so interesting to talk with you, Dr. Michael Okun. You are one of the four authors of Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. I learned a huge amount from reading this book, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
It's my pleasure to be here, and thanks to everyone that is joining the fight in Parkinson. And we invite everybody to become a PD Avenger and, you know, and to send cards to the White House and just get your voice heard.
Dr. Robert Okun has served as the National Medical Director for the Parkinson's Foundation since 2006 and was recognized in the 2015 White House ceremony as a champion of change for Parkinson's disease. Go to writersvoice.net for links to the website for the Ending PD campaign. There are loads of resources there and ways that you can help. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Anne Armbrecht about her groundbreaking book about the herbal supplement industry, The Business of Botanicals. We also learn all about recycling from Jenny Romer. Her book is Can I Recycle This? Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.